instead of filtered through the palatability gauze of a news channel, brought the same sense of comfort one gets from the cable guy or gal who was there in person, actually solving your problem hands-on, versus your trying to discuss the issue with a random helpline operator by phone or email. I asked him a question that had been occurring to me over the last 4 years, but especially since the pandemic had begun. Did he think our species' propensity for killing each other quickly, like in war or genocide, or slowly, like with systemic racism, including the wealth gap, real estate redlining, the incarceration system, and so forth, as well as our indifference to our responsibility for climate change, in addition to this newly obvious penchant for actually killing ourselves, with the dum-dums screaming their defiant ignorance as they spit a deadly virus into each other's faces? Could this be Mother Nature striking a balance? Like, the plague itself can easily be seen as a population equalizer, but on top of that, how is it that our human organism can blindly reason itself into shooting itself in the foot or worse? He told me about a great book by Richard Dawkins called The Selfish Gene, in which Dawkins extensively argues that the idea that altruistic behavior would somehow be good for the survival of the species is fallacious. It simply stems from human beings' desire to attach a morality to our behaviors. In truth, in Darwin's Fight Club, it's the self-serving, aggressive, competitive traits that best serve a species' chances for perpetuation. Okay, I had to cut him off again. I told him he had to take it down a notch, or somebody at Dutton was going to make me start citing his shit with footnotes like a real writer. That was plenty enough science for me, and it served nicely as a conversational springboard into musings then about what a piece of work is man, and the conundrums presented by the particularly human dichotomy of greed and selflessness. We are a people who can produce a Leopold family and a Rebanks family and have them inspire an entire watershed in the world beyond with their attention to the mutually beneficial methods of agrarian farming, and then simultaneously see our modern agricultural schools completely funded by the food corporations, racing in the other direction with all haste toward the singular goal of the almighty dollar. Will we be able to turn the boat of our nation and our planet around in time to save ourselves from engendering an extinction event? Things are bleak from many points of view, but still, I am hopeful about our chances. As I said to Esteban, once my new book hits the shelves, that should fix everything. We spent the rest of the descent talking about gear. He was pitching me on the effectiveness of hiking poles, while I attempted to sell him on clip-in bicycle shoes, as well as how much we both adored Conan O'Brien. I thanked him sincerely for his tolerance of my eager questioning and wished him godspeed on his drive to San Diego, then went to find Megan back at the Nutmeg. She'd made these incredible pizzas on focaccia crust, to which we gave a proper holiday send-off as sundown approached on New Year's Eve. We were sitting in our comfy camp chairs under our comfy awning while our fairy lights twinkled on the Nutmeg. It was pretty nice, if you're into romance and picture-perfect purple sunsets and pizza. Across the lawn area, about 40 yards off, we noticed our cute neighbor couple, who looked to be in their late 60s or early 70s, messing about behind their camper. I had discovered their names to be Pat and Judy. He was tall, regal, and slightly round, and she was relatively tiny and bird-like and pretty. We had remarked upon them the day before when we saw them park their tiny little bubble camper that was not much bigger than the queen-size bed it housed, and set up a couple of chairs, coolers, a tabletop propane grill on the picnic table, and what appeared to be a 5-foot-tall wooden saguaro cactus painted green. It also had little white Christmas lights draped on it. Sorry, holiday lights. All of these items were surrounding a 10-foot square of linoleum, or something like it, its corners held securely down by 4-gallon jugs of water. Just as we finished cleaning up our dinner dishes, we heard music starting up over at their spot. It was When a Man Loves a Woman by Percy Sledge. We scooted our chairs closer together and snuggled up, holding hands and making sure that Clover had a comfortable perch on our laps, as Judy and Pat began to dance. The surface they'd so carefully laid out was their dance floor. They were wearing dancing shoes. Hers looked like character shoes that a dance instructor might favor, and his looked like burgundy suede, built for jazz. I had previously seen this phenomenon in my own parents as they seemed to glide about the dance floor at wedding receptions, their feet barely touching the ground, but these two lovebirds were truly exceptional. From Judy's carriage and form, Megan immediately identified her as a former professional dancer, and we agreed that the two of them must have done some class together, because Pat was no slouch either. As the sun sank below the jagged skyline and their cactus lights began to take full effect, they glided and sashayed, two beauties moving as one, thrilling us where we sat, as though we were secretly spying on a Fred and Ginger rehearsal. The next day, Pat and I were both packing up our campsites, and I told them that we loved their dancing, and Megan was especially moved, being the former ballerina in the house. He shyly shrugged, thanked me, and said they had been doing that together for more than 40 years. I said sincerely that their moves looked quite youthful. Not to mention that they must have been somewhat spry to be getting along in such a wee camper. "You know," he said, "it gets a little tight in that thing sometimes, a little close. But then she just asks me to go for a walk, and I'm glad to do it. Usually, though, we just get along." "I know what you mean," I said. 20 years in, and the rare fight doesn't ever seem to stick very long. I guess we picked right. We're lucky enough to love each other." Pat smiled. "Well, sure. It's pretty nice, ain't it?" Chapter 21. Sedona Blows. If you don't know Sedona, Arizona, perfect. My first impulse is that I would like to keep it that way. Nothing infuriates me more than when some tastemaker publishes the details of the amazing hole-in-the-wall burrito stall near your wood shop, rendering it forevermore unavailable because of the now line around the block you don't have time to go stand in because you're trying to run a business. So, Sedona is not that great. It's too crowded and you probably won't like it. The Rock is all red, so boring. We went there anyway because we love to be disappointed. And I was hiking a trail that I don't think you would care for, but I was having really a pretty wonderful time, not because it was gorgeous, but because I am a creative person. This route required some bouldering and some spider-like scrambling up a couple of sheer rock faces that had just enough incline that I was only able to ascend by staying flat, nose to the rock, as I scrambled up. If you're not familiar with extreme alpine adventuring, they call this free soloing, which some of us do just for ourselves, Alex for the thrill, even if a film camera is not trained upon our prowess. Once I had crested this garbage trail, I sat on a rock and had a cup of tea that was so goddamn reborative that I think I morphed into Jim Carter for a minute. Mr. Carson from Downton Abbey, a paragon of proper comportment, gazing out upon Sedona's notoriously blasé vistas, With My Tea, Portland Breakfast, by Stephen Smith Teamaker, I savored a massive hiking cookie. Mr. Carson would have, of course, called it a prodigious constitutional biscuit, packed with oats, chocolate, nuts, and protein. My indulgent solace was suddenly shattered when two young men on mountain bikes came catapulting around the corner, flying smoothly through the air until they touched down and zipped around the next bend and out of sight. The whole episode took all of 5 seconds, and everything was surreally quiet except for the breeze whistling past these riders and the zzzz of the free hub bodies in the rear tires. I reflected that I had seen a few small instances of tire tread tracks in different places on my way up here, but hadn't really given them much thought until I actually saw these bikers. It was wildly impressive on this underwhelming trail in a location that you should not visit. I pressed on to the backside of the mountain, and you know, can we just take a minute to talk about trails? The trails themselves are such a huge part of the draw for me, even in a visual butthole like Sedona. I'm talking about the actual physical makeup, the construction of the walkway itself, which is one of the oldest creations, perhaps the oldest, of creatures on the planet. As we wake from our sleeping spot and amble to our tinkling spot, then stroll on to the blueberry patch, and then back to the napping and smooching place after all of that exertion, and we do this again and again, day after day, our route becomes traced into the soil and eventually inspires a person in New Jersey to invent the toll road. Paths, roads, trajectories, crossroads. Their symbolism fuels our human narrative, and a great deal of emphasis is placed upon the life choices that ultimately determine whether or not we manage to stay on the right path. Over my 51 years, I have taken on board a lot of messaging, usually from people trying to sell me shit, about chasing my dreams and reaching for the stars, and basically being as ambitious as possible. And maybe that route to that definition of success works for some people, but I can't say that it's really been my experience. I personally do a much better job at feeling successful by making smaller moves and reading the organic signs that life sends my way. Thoreau wrote, "Pursue some path, however narrow and crooked, in which you can walk with love and reverence." Wherever a man separates from the multitude and goes his own way, there is a fork in the road, though the travelers along the highway see only a gap in the paling. And I feel like this is the quote that people think that Frost's The Road Not Taken is trying to be, missing the rather sharper point of that famous poem. Where Frost is pointing up our human penchant to revise or rationalize our own decision-making histories, Thoreau is merely advising us to pick a lane, which I take to mean get to work making what appeals to you, and choose your turns and straightaways by paying attention to the idiosyncrasies that organically appeal to you. Flipping my gaze back onto the real-life physical manifestation of this topic, it's the narrow and crooked path that delights me the most, like when the way winds downhill through old-growth trees, so that over the years a sort of staircase has developed using the exposed roots of the trees, or the many sections of trail that utilize nature's stones to create stair steps, or the old English phenomenon known as a hollow way, which is when a well-worn path is flanked by rows of trees, whose branches arch to join each other above the path, creating a visual tunnel that thrills the imagination. Above and beyond the natural path peccadilloes, I also adore all of the amazing construction and maintenance that has gone into the trails we enjoy. I'm especially aware of it when I'm miles into a mountain trek and I come to a footbridge, built with timbers or concrete or steel, or maybe a set of dozens of steps up a steep cliffside. As I said while hiking the ruins of the old ore tramway in Texas, I can't help but recognize that some hardy souls had to haul these materials all the way out or up here, and then put in the hours and days of labor required to achieve their designs far from running water and electricity. So that we may safely enjoy them, the many, many miles of enjoyable paths on private and public park land require some degree of maintenance and caring attention, and I am deeply grateful to the ladies and gents responsible. I had to do a little homework to discover that a gap in the paling refers to the spaces between slats in, like, a slatted fence or picket fence. I like that notion of Thoreau's quite a bit, that whatever attracts a body to fork off the path on their own is but a blip to the rest of the world, going past too fast or distracted to notice what lies through the slits between fence pickets. Apparently, I wasn't the only traveler to be taken in by the crappy offerings of the Sedona outdoorscape, as I presently came upon another lone biker cruising up the hill toward me on a mountain bike with fat balloon tires. We were in a dry stream bed with an assortment of rounded river stones populating the trail, strewn generously about and varying in size from golf ball to baseball to basketball, but the fellow simply pedaled steadily up the incline and swerved hither and yon without an apparent care in the world. "That just doesn't seem possible," I said as he passed within a few feet of me. He simply laughed and proceeded up the trail and out of sight. I was duly impressed by the athleticism required to ride in this fashion, and thought again of the moments earlier in the day when I had scrambled up a rock face only to discover a tire track in a small deposit of dirt along the stone trail. This then made me recall further my time in the redwood-forested hills of Santa Cruz, when I was running the wonderful trails there and I had some encounters with cyclists. In that setting, the young mountain bikers had set up earthen jumps along the trail, engineered at the bottom of steep hills so that a rider could gain the utmost downhill speed before being launched off the ground. The result was some pretty remarkable airtime, which culminated in a precarious landing that required a quick swerve to avoid being thrown off the trail into a tree. The first time I witnessed it was nearly my last, as I came running unwittingly from the other direction around a bend, and a woman on the side of the trail said, "Heads up," just before her companion came flying on his bicycle literally higher than my head. She was shooting video of him on her phone, and I weakly exclaimed and half-ducked as the bike landed well past me. I was frightened, and they were embarrassed, but they apologized, and I suggested they bring little signs to post, or perhaps some version of yellow crime scene tape to slow oncoming traffic. Some years ago, while hiking the mountains above Santa Barbara, I was fully frightened by two mountain bikers in full stormtrooper-style body armor and helmets, who came barreling past me in a fashion that made me dive off the trail to avoid being hit. I managed to yell, "Hey!" before they vanished down the steep trail. So obviously, I like to utilize trails much more slowly and simply than some cyclists I have known. I don't begrudge them their trail time, even those who are apparently in it solely for the thrill of the gaps and the paling. I'm down with adrenaline-inducing fun times and have enjoyed a variety of them over the years, but uh-oh, here comes Mr. Carson, the Edwardian butler again. I feel like we could all use a refresher on our manners. If I am going to water ski on a lake, I will do my best to stay within the allotted zone and far from any no-wake zones, where swimmers and canoeists depend upon the lack of violent boat waves for safety and quietude. Similarly, if I'm biking on a mountain trail that is most frequented by pedestrians, I would hate to be so thoughtless of others as to go tearing around blind corners. It all continues to come back to remembering that none of us is an island, and that we really do have to think of others in the ways we use, well, everything. I continued down the backside of this trail thinking these incredibly deep thoughts, and wondering if I should bother sending them to Mensa, or, I don't know, the Dalai Lama? MIT? MI6? My unspeakably ugly trail, never visit here if you're smart, was tracing the right bank of a sizable dry river wash, and eventually a rough, rocky back road emerged across the wash, flanking the left bank as I loped ever homeward. Before long, I began to hear the growl of an off-road engine powering its way up the trail, eventually drawing near to me on the other side of the riverbed. Unfortunately, I was to discover that this was only the first of several of these vehicles that would be my intermittent but constant companions for the remaining few hours of my hike. They were extra-long, pink Jeep-type vehicles from a tour company, creatively titled Pink Jeep Tours. Behind the front seat of each open-air truck were housed two or three bench seats, so they could carry maybe 6 to 10 passengers per vehicle. Before the engine came into earshot, I could actually first hear the driver guide elocuting over a loudspeaker system to his wards mere feet behind him, to give you some idea how obnoxiously loud this operation was. The first one brought me up short, and I just stared as they trundled slowly past my location and on up the road. The first driver was seriously speaking the following words, at the volume of an auctioneer at a farm estate sale. I don't care where it is. I just love to get out in nature and sit with the sounds and smells to get away from civilization. I'll let you run the math on that one real quick before hitting you with the next Jeep's narration maybe 20 minutes later. A passenger asked, are there any gold mines out here? And the driver answered, I don't think so. Maybe south of here. You can pan for it in Oak Creek, though. My neighbor got a ton panning, but in the 90s. And then, as they passed from hearing, the passenger said, have you ever seen that show? Okay. So I was in enough disbelief at how dumb this whole scene was, but also how sublime their snippets of dialogue were, that I got my phone out and made a voice memo, for which I'm so thankful, because otherwise you could not ever credit the rap emanating from the third Jeep. I'm talking about, you know, it's the age of Aquarius, and the age of Aquarius is about being conscious of your place in the universe and your impact on those around you, even right here. Okay, so I mean, I get it, that I'd been out in the platonic ideal of a meditative natural experience, even in the utter toilet that is Sedona. So at some point, I should not have been surprised to have my starry-eyed trance shattered. But you have to admit that this irony delivery method was pretty goddamn rich. By the way, it's not lost on me that all of us are sometimes the whiskery guy on the trail, and sometimes we're buckled into the back of a pink Jeep, and still other times we're the amateur astrologer, rolling out our musings on the age of Aquarius when the moon is in the 7th house and whatnot. Only a few years ago, Megan and I took a helicopter tour of an area called Secret Mountain. Horrible. 0 stars. Don't go. Which featured heartbreaking scenic beauty wherever one looked, threading through impossible-to-reach slot canyons and culminating in close views of ancient adobe and stone homes of the Sinaguan people, tucked into open cliffside caverns that rendered them otherwise impossible to observe. This was a highlight of our trip, even our year, despite how shitty everything looked. but I'm sure that simultaneously there were hikers and other people enjoying the serenity of nature who passionately raised their middle fingers at our chopper as it thundered past. It begs the question, is there a right way to use nature? If so, what is it? I don't believe I'm any kind of expert, but I can't help imagining that the versions involving walking and bicycles would probably score better than the ones with the helicopter and the pink Jeep with Dolby surround sound. Just like actual grass-fed eggs from one's own county would score better than those from an egg factory one or two states over. Of course, there are nuances to this argument, such as ensuring that the elderly, the infirm, and the disabled are able to enjoy nature to an extent. But what is the extent? People in unattractive communities like Sedona are deriving their incomes from these jeeps and helicopters and hotels and restaurants. So what about their welfare? Where do we draw the line? The pink Jeep version of this experience feels representative to me of an especially American recreation. My parents' generation, boomers, grew up with such a proliferation of vehicles on the road that there was more than one car for every two Americans, or loosely 100 million automobiles. In 2020, 50 years later, the United States had 286.9 million registered vehicles. Internal combustion engines are so ubiquitous that it seems perfectly natural most of the time to solve a problem with a gas-powered vehicle. In this way, the pink Jeep is not dissimilar to my Ford Expedition. They are both burning fossil fuels to transport a small number of people to their recreation. So let's say the owners of the pink Jeeps read this book, and they realize that they should find another way to earn a living, and they send me a handwritten apology and a card that also contains a gift code for a nice ice cream place. Let's also surmise that I succumb to the guilt I feel at the hypocrisy of caring about Mother Nature and her grand economy while burning tons of gas on our road trips. So I give up the Ford and, I guess, park the nutmeg somewhere hopefully good. Obviously not Sedona, gross. Will these actions be enough to turn climate change around? Will the pink Jeep people and I be heralded as environmental heroes, receiving even more ice cream gift credits from Greta Thunberg herself? Hell no, we won't. What we need to do is print enough copies of this book, or I guess that kills too many trees, so make sure to use recycled paper and also distribute as many digital and audio copies as possible. This is good. I like reading the book for the audience, and if you're listening right now, thank you for doing your part to shame the loud Jeep people and save the planet. If you plan on later reading this on paper, well, I guess you have some thinking to do. Don't distract me. We take an ass load of my books and fill all the newly cleared shelf space in all the schools and libraries where all the Ta-Nehisi Coates books used to sit, but now they've been burned because of how we can no longer teach critical race theory and a lot of the bad shit we did in the 400 or 500 years of white human history in this country, in which we're supposed to believe everything was cool and nothing we did was wrong, because of God and how good white people are at shit like flawless constitutions and civil rights. Right? We fill the shelf space with copies of my book and add it to every curriculum, and then, once everybody has understood the revolutionary ideas I have gifted mankind, then we will... Ah, damn it. Okay, we're going to need some smart people. We take the smart people and we get them to strategize a way to convince our legislators the people whom we ostensibly choose to represent our wishes over the nefariously purchased preferences of corporate interests nationwide, in the ways they legislate the laws of the states and the country, that we care more about climate change than white supremacy, that we care more about the health of our farms and farmers and our food systems than we do about being able to wear our guns into more public places, that we care more about people than money. But I guess that begs the question, do we? Epilogue. Oh, give me a home where the buffalo roam, where the deer and the antelope play, where never is heard a discouraging word, and the sky is not clouded all day. These are the opening lines to a poem entitled My Western Home, penned by Dr. Brewster M. Higley in 1872 or 73, about his life as a Kansas homesteader. The verses were subsequently published in the Smith County Pioneer newspaper in 1874. A friend of his set them to music, and the song traveled all about the country, undergoing some minor tweaks, but largely staying true to the original, until it was published in the 1910 book Cowboy Songs and Other Frontier Ballads by folklorist John Lomax. At some point, a realist got a hold of the third line, where never is heard a discouraging word, and changed never to seldom. Because, I mean, come on, even on the otherwise placid range, they were only human. The new 20th century was not going to begrudge a pioneer a few cusses over a stubbed toe or a badger in the henhouse. Or maybe somebody got within earshot of the Kansas reservations housing the remnants of the Kickapoo, Iowa, Potawatomi, and Sac and Fox tribes. Methinks there may have been a clearly audible discouraging word or two issuing forth from the Native Americans, trying to swallow the raw deals they had been handed. Another unknown lyricist added this stanza at some point. The red man was pressed from this part of the West. He's likely no more to return to the banks of Red River, where seldom, if ever, their flickering campfires burn. An uncharacteristically thoughtful verse with an air of melancholy, almost as though the writer understands the responsibility of the song's narrator and all they stand for in the disappearance of the, quote, red man. By the time Bing Crosby recorded his version in 1933, the song was officially known as Home on the Range, and when it was legally adopted as the state song of Kansas in 1947, the, quote, red man verse was conspicuously absent. But another original verse remained, slightly tweaked into this. How often at night, when the heavens are bright, with the light of the twinkling stars, have I stood here amazed, and asked as I gazed, if their glory exceeds that of ours. Okay, hold up. This verse just comes right out and handsomely rhymes our hubris, positing the question of whose glory is greater, us humans or the stars in the firmament. I hope you will permit me another rare LOL, as we dumbshits effectively erased the verse with any sort of self-reckoning regarding the crimes we committed against the Native Americans, and instead mused on whether we were perhaps the most glorious things in the cosmos. This fits pretty neatly into the drawer of songs celebrating the incredibly one-sided achievements of white America, like America the Beautiful, which is a song full of reinforcement for the Christian God-ordained actions of the conquering, liberating American pilgrims and heroes. The argument that our nation should be allied with any one religion, or religion at all, is simply bonkers. It's about as solipsistic as thinking can get, to somehow try to reconcile the supposed American ideals of diversity and freedom for all with those of your church, or synagogue, or mosque, but I believe it's mainly the churches that are pissing in this particular bed. If our national sloganeering and jingoistic jingles don't recognize the varied nuances of humanity by acknowledging our past mistakes and crimes against and our present dependence upon said variety, then those refrains are not patriotic at all, they're nationalist. The Catholic Church in which I was raised was big on penance. If they want to impress us with their sincere devotion, why not repent by way of reparations for the presently unanswered sins of our past? A true national or state anthem should absolutely cop to our iniquities. If America is going to have any hope of one day being great, it will be by finally facing slavery, genocide, domestic terrorism, Japanese-American internment camps, and the list of commensurate evils that runs right up to today and into tomorrow. If a person bases their worldview on the lyrics of these old songs, it's not surprising that they could easily end up indoctrinated into the white power army, even unwittingly. How can a song extol the so-called glories of this nation without mentioning the exemplary heroics of our civil rights activists and suffragists and abolitionists? The more contemporary Lee Greenwood right-wing anthem, God Bless the USA, not to put too fine a point on it, includes the lines, "There's pride in every American heart," and "I'm proud to be an American." Statements powerfully ignorant to the quality of life of the majority of his fellow citizens once you add up the minorities, the victims of many stripes of discrimination, and those living in poverty. Perhaps if Mr. Greenwood wanted to improve the accuracy of his writing, for a start he should insert the word white in front of each appearance of American in those verses, then add the word straight between the two. His song also features the refrain, "God Bless the USA." But I wonder how he and his fans would square the blind braggadocio of his words with this little ditty from our old friend the King James Bible, Book of Proverbs 16:18. "Pride goeth before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall, bitch." The day Megan and I packed up to drive home from our nutmeg adventure started out pretty unremarkably. We retracted the awnings, battened down the remaining pieces of Megan's brown butter cake, and were just about to switch off the news and bid farewell to the just plain unpleasant ass canker called Sedona, when all of a sudden it was as though these white pride songs had come to life, complete with Confederate flags and angry, violent, white insurrectionists on the TV, beating police officers and storming our nation's Capitol building. The date was January 6th, 2021. We stood in shock, yea, and awe, and stared for half an hour or so in sheer disbelief. Snapping back into the focus required of a long travel day, 9 hours on the road or so, we finished buttoning up and began to haul our nutmeg west, all the while glued to the radio. You know how it played out, and the unfurling shit blossoms responsible are not remotely done either. The insurrection movement, I mean. Which, I guess, based on their voting to oppose an investigation into the selfsame insurrection, means that the movement, Stop the Steal, the Big Lie, the January 6 traitors, has now become synonymous with the Republican Party. Somehow, despite the noble efforts of Megan, Clover, and myself to wallow in some light escapism for several weeks as we traipsed about the Southwest and canoodled on the banks of the Rio Grande in our cute Airstream Globetrotter, wolfing down pasta and enchiladas, The present evil of the indecent leading the blind appears to be going nowhere soon. I silently renewed my promise to myself and all humankind to fix everything by writing this lightweight meander of a nonfiction title. You're welcome. A few weeks after we arrived home in Los Angeles, I finally got to try out a new recreational activity about which I had long been curious. My producer pal Marvin had invited me to go stand-up paddleboarding in the Pacific Ocean. As it turned out, we launched the boards near the California Yacht Club in Marina del Rey, which also has a public access put-in. Now, I'll remind you that I'm a Midwestern lake and river guy, so even just being on this relatively calm water, protected from the ocean's swells by a distant breakwater, was pretty thrilling. Part of my adrenaline was being generated by the fact that stand-up paddleboarding is a bit of a balancing act that is relatively manageable once you get the hang of it, but it's still precarious. You have to actively stand still as hard as you can. We paddled out into the main channel of the marina, where the primary danger was riding out the wakes created by the various boats coming and going, which may or may not have fomented some giggles, a few gasps, and perhaps even a squeal of terrified delight or two, as I barely managed to stay out of the drink. A second unnerving factor was the presence of enormous sea lions lazing about the marina, which, although relatively benign, still occasionally enjoyed playing with us by popping up in unexpectedly close proximity, which was startling at least, especially when they can achieve weights of up to 700 pounds. The water is perfectly opaque, so it's easy for an Illinois lad to start imagining what might lie beneath the dark surface, while he comforts himself with the thought that H.P. Lovecraft's stories of the old ones are primarily centered in New England. Then, just as he terrifyingly recalls that Cthulhu's favorite haunt, the sunken city of Relay, is actually held to be in the South Pacific, a snuffling monster head the size of a 5-gallon bucket breaches the waves a few feet from his paddle, and he squeals with terror, but then quickly laughs to let everyone, Marvin, know that he is an American man, trademark, a special type of coward who must pretend at all costs to feel no fear, despite how stupid that is in reality. It was just the right amount of exhilarating to be great fun and a surprisingly effective workout as well. We made our way the couple of miles out to the huge breakwater protecting the marina inlet, then turned back toward our dock. On our way in, we wove in and out of the 5,000 or so boats moored in this marina. Marvin said that some of these watercraft were garbage, worth literally $0 or even less, given the cost required to either fix them up or remove them. On the other end of the spectrum, however, were the massive yachts, worth in the neighborhood of 75 or even 100 million. I can't believe I didn't fall off my board upon hearing that. There were dozens upon dozens of these giant yachts, ranging from classic-looking wooden sailboats to shiny, modern fiberglass monstrosities that looked like if an apartment building had a baby with a bullet train. Now, again, I don't want to come across as hypocritical here. I come from a family that owns at least 4 or 5 fishing boats, not including my canoe. But I do think there's a demonstrable difference between an 18-foot bass boat that has a specific utility, drinking beer, and a $40 million house that floats. I'm not so much interested in judging these yacht owners, as there are myriad other examples of gross excess in our society, as I am in simply examining this juxtaposition in which I found myself standing, or wobbling, to be more accurate. Looking at a medium-sized version of one of these pleasure boats, I was filled with wonder. It had accommodations so deluxe that you wouldn't even know you were on the water. If you could ignore the heave and swell of the ocean, you could just chill on the $20,000 couch and watch the abyss on the big screen, powering through maybe some nachos that the chef whipped up. What does it say about us, I wondered, that somehow our idea of luxury is to take the undeniably enjoyable experience of being on the water, feeling the breeze, soaking in the weather, perhaps catching our dinner, and then wrap it up in extreme comfort and decor until we have turned a boat into a floating McMansion, spoke the man with a massage parlor in his truck seat. I was standing there literally looking in the windows of these yachts wondering this, teetering on my paddleboard. The other glaring fact that hit me was that nobody was there. These boats were all sitting there, unused. Marvin's brother works in San Diego as a charter captain on boats like these big ones, and he says that they'll average maybe a couple of weekends of use per year. This seems crazy, I thought. Here I was, having an amazing few hours on the water, enjoying the elements and getting some exercise to boot, all for the price of a paddleboard and paddle, both items which I could make if I needed to. Since then, I've gone back a handful of times for more laps around the marina, and I look forward to going again this week as a treat for finishing this recording. The objective of our efforts, both that day and since, is not dissimilar to that of a hike, isolating oneself in an envelope of nature where all you need to do is walk or paddle to have a terrific time. The sun and the salt water and the exertion leave me feeling great after a long morning paddle, like I've done something positive, even productive. Now, supposedly, according to the message of capitalism, I should be dissatisfied with my paddleboard, especially when faced with these gargantuan, opulent surrogate penises. The quote, "American way demands that I shouldn't rest until I have extra millions to blow on a boat like this so that it can sit here in its expensive mooring, because it's not so much for me to use as it is for me to own." There's something to this, I thought, as the occasional smaller, more modest boat headed out to sea passed us. People perhaps intending to fish or maybe perform scientific research on the ocean. The juxtaposition of our responsible use of nature with our ownership of it was hanging there for me to pluck. I recalled a conversation between Neil Young and Conan O'Brien on Conan's podcast, in which they were extolling the forgotten virtues of playing music on vinyl records instead of digital media. Neil talked about how American it was to need to be able to store thousands of songs on your device, as though that holds some sort of power. But he then added, "You can only play one song at a time, man." Jay Leno's famous hoard of classic cars is worth over $50 million. But no one is allowed to visit it, meaning the 169 automobiles and 117 motorcycles serve little purpose. I get it. Cars are cool. And I don't begrudge anybody collecting things they like, but I also feel like we can encourage one another to invest in human beings instead of billionaire yachts that remain docked and shockingly expensive hot rods that nobody gets to drive. Patrick Kavanagh was a 20th century Irish poet who was celebrated for the value he placed upon the commonplace and the mundane, and I feel like Leopold and Neil Young would both agree with this idea of his. To know fully even one field or one land is a lifetime's experience. In the world of poetic experience, it is depth that counts, not width. A gap in a hedge, a smooth rock surfacing a narrow lane, a view of a woody meadow, the stream at the junction of four small fields. These are as much as a man can fully experience. As I'm recording these final pages, the world remains in turmoil. Where the news should be touting the nation's collective achievement of herd immunity by way of mass vaccination, it is instead filled with stories of herd idiocy. Fueled by a fire hose of misinformation and conspiracy theory, large percentages of Republicans are frighteningly, quote, not confident about the results of President Biden's landslide victory in the 2020 election over their sad boy. Something as irreproachable as the benefit of powerful vaccines is being insincerely questioned on Fox News, not for reasons of legitimate concern, but to score mere political points, even at their viewers' peril. To wit, states with low vaccination rates are loudly cheered at the Conservative Political Action Conference. Three celebrity billionaires, meanwhile, are truly exploring the question of whether their glory might exceed that of the stars by launching themselves veritable inches higher than they had previously been vaulted. And they still cannot remotely dunk. The entire continent of Africa has received a tragic paucity of vaccine doses, along with many other poor countries in Asia, the Middle East, and Central and South America, but we Americans are so abhorrent as to turn our noses up at this life-saving medicine until it actually expires and goes to waste, while our wealthiest playboys play rocket ship grab-ass giggle tag. I'd like to show Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, and Richard Branson the world casualty numbers based on other countries' extreme poverty. Then ask if they're proud to be Americans. Maybe we should ask the twinkling stars if they're impressed yet. Meanwhile, as a squadron of Air Force Blue Angels thunders past across the sky during a patriotic air show costing six figures per flyover, I'd love for Lee Greenwood to ask a teeming homeless encampment under a highway overpass if they are proud to be Americans. Mother Nature is not an American, and she is not proud. She is all creation, so her vibe encompasses all experience, in every size, shape, and color, from the high to the low. Her economy and its successful evolution thrive on diversity, and her children never rest in their glorious participation, reproducing and adapting so as to grow ever stronger. A farm, therefore, as a mini version of her creation, just a few dozen acre size scale model, requires as much variety as possible because in diversity is strength. A proliferation of species sets up support systems in every direction. To depend upon monocultures, on the other hand, is to invest in a fragile system that opposes nature, literally goes to war with her, requiring more and more chemical weaponry, both as fertilizer and as poison in the forms of herbicide and insecticide. The same Darwinian notion is true of a nation or a state or a county. A diverse neighborhood is eminently more powerful than a homogeneous one. Ben and Jerry's full menu of flavors is gonna crush plain vanilla every time. I also know that if I can manage to keep an eye on my bird feeder and my wood shop and my farmer's market and my family more than my online shopping cart, and if I can simply continue to enjoy my canoe, then I might just remember that actually nobody needs a yacht. It's a daunting project, this remembrance, but since we continue to own a mirror in our household, try as I might to avoid it, I catch the occasional glimpse of myself and am reminded regularly that I'm a dipshit. You might think that I would not like to be reminded of this fact, but on the contrary, I am always grateful for the knowledge, because it is the starting point. When I recall my fallibility as a human, it comes as a relief to remember that I still have more work to do, and that the work will never cease until my hands give out. Were I to forget my need to attempt good work, the resultant void would create a dangerously empty frame of mind in me which I would need to fill up in my newly idle time, and so I would begin to cast about, based upon the predilections of an idler, for diversions or maybe something shiny to collect. And before you know it, I might end up with one of those yachts. By chasing the work that I deem good, I instead get to experience astonishing moments, as excellent as anything Perseus ever pulled off, like diving into a glacial Montana river with my great friend George, or falling together to the earth in mortal wonder as we witnessed our brother Jeff's feats of daring, stamina, and courage in the deep wilderness of Glacier National Park. Although I'll note that as good as those adventures were, I don't think they would have been diminished a whit if the parks were given back to the indigenous tribes to run. I feel like the work would actually feel better all around, in fact. Thanks to following the nose on my face, the very nose that I employ to sniff out the avenues of my good work, I have avoided purchasing any collectible vehicles of any sort by instead feeding hay in winter to some absolute units of Herdwick sheep and savoring each blown cool spoonful of ham and bean broth and meeting the Queen of the Belties, who was more than happy to answer James's questions about belted Galloway cows and mine about her aerodynamic tits. I have delighted in the work of learning about regenerative, sustainable farming in the UK and America alike, and I have very much enjoyed investigating the beefy, porky, eggy fruits of its grass-fed ambitions. As delicious as these goodies have been, I feel like they could be even tastier were they to come from black farmers working land they've received in reparation from the currently extant wealth of the plantations that so dearly and clearly still owe them. Because of the generosity and patience of my travel companion, Megan, and our navigator and co-pilot, Clover, my work has taken me to a hard-won confluence of family and a microbiologically educational mountain ramble, with some lessons in future romance and ballroom dancing thrown in for good measure. I know I'll make more mistakes in the years to come, but if I can keep to my narrow and crooked path, I might even try some hiking poles when my knees begin to gripe loudly enough. The bad news is, it doesn't look like I'm going to be getting any smarter or cuter, but the good news is that I can find smart, curious, progressive, empathetic people to follow and support. People who are more interested in seeing my smiles than my tears. We must understand that each and every one of us is a cog or a wheel in the ecosystem of Leopold's parlance, and that, like it or not, you need me. And I need you, every gorgeous goddamn one of you, to continue to engender the ethics of agrarianism throughout the world, to save our food systems, our farmers, our civilization, and ultimately ourselves. It's the biggest no-brainer in the history of mankind.
Give me a home where the buffalo roam, where the deer and the antelope play, where seldom is heard a discouraging word, and the skies are not clear. Deep.
This is Nick Offerman. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Where the Deer and the Antelope Play, the pastoral observations of one ignorant American who loves to walk outside. This program was directed by Ruth Lichtman, executive producer Sarah Jaffe, edited by Ted Scott. Home on the Range, performed by Megan Mullally. Copyright Casablanca Kids, Inc., on behalf of itself and Flying South Productions. Lines from Sand County Almanac and Sketches Here and There by Aldo Leopold, copyright Oxford University Press, Incorporated, 2020. Reproduced with permission of the licensor through PLS Clear. Text copyright 2021 by Nick Offerman. Production copyright 2021. Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.